The only way you get to futures that you want is by steering towards those futures, not by steering away from the futures you don't want. We can now today construct a medical assistant that's better than the average GP, available 24/7 at $5 or less per hour.
AI will not be like flawless. It will make mistakes.
I think we agree that waiting for perfection is actually, in fact, will cause a lot of human suffering.
You will be made happy, or we will enhance your agency whether you want it or not, because this will be better for you. Actually, you cannot really opt out of internet these days. No. You cannot opt out of highway this way. You have a choice or you don't have a choice.
Should we then go provide those AI doctors to, for example, rural, African, other kinds of communities? They go, no. And you're like, you are being patronizing. Yes, we should ask them. We should tell them what the worries are. But if they choose to engage, that is their own adult decisions because they know their well-beings.
Hey, I'm Alexander, and welcome to Before AGI. AI isn't just coming. It's already here. And while there is no shortage of discussions about AI transformative power, both good and bad, those conversations often float somewhere in the abstract. What we rarely get to explore are the tangible scenarios, the specifics. What does the future shaped by AI actually look like? And perhaps even more crucially, why might we want to embrace it? Today, we will get more concrete. Today, I have the pleasure of hosting Reid Hoffman. Reid has been on this show before, but he has kept busy since our last conversation. In particular, he has co-authored a new book with Greg Beato called Super Agency, with a provocative subtitle, What Could Possibly Go Right with Our AI Future? As the subtitle says it, this book paints a vivid picture of a positive AI future, one we can genuinely look forward to. So today, Reid and I dive into this vision, unpacking what super agency could mean for our lives, our society, and our future. Let's get into it. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
You kept busy since the last time we spoke. In particular, you wrote a new book, Super Agency. And I must ask, like, you always were pretty positive about AI. At that time, when I asked you about why, you think you wanted a little bit to be a counterweight to a lot of what you would call doomerism narrative about AI. But I would say that since then, the narrative somewhat shifted. I think there is many more people who are optimistic about AI. Mm. So who is this book for? Is it for the optimist, for the pessimist? Who is the audience for this book?
There's two audiences. I do still think that a lot of the audience is still much more pessimistic than it should be. So in the book, we do this doomers, AI is going to destroy everything, do everything you can to slow it down. Gloomers, AI is inevitable, but it's going to be bad. Zoomers, which is, no, AI is just magical. Close your eyes, hit the accelerator. Everything is going to be great. And bloomers, where I put you and me in, which is, look, the future of AI can be very good. Let's drive intelligently. Let's navigate some risks, et cetera, as ways of doing it. And that's legitimately where my position is. But there's still a lot of people who advocate in the other three camps, the doomer camp, the gloomer camp, and the zoomer camp, all of which Bloomer is advocating against. So for those, the people in those camps, it's trying to say, here is why you should be AI optimistic, AI curious, and also AI intelligent in navigating the risk. And depending on which camp you're in, it's a different vector of motion. Now, there's another more subtle thing around folks like yourself. People are at the center of creating the AI kind of revolution, which is a focus on human agency and to think about as in a design prospect. And this doesn't mean that AI won't replace a lot of human tasks, won't replace some human jobs. That's not what a focus on human agency prevents. It's a focus on, hey, what is this when the tool set is transforming our lives and society? What is the way that when it's on the other side of this, human agency is greatly enhanced? And that's what every technological revolution has led to, and that's what we should be doing here. And obviously, we can go to as much depth as this particular conversation wants to go on, kind of what does human agency mean around agentic technology, around creating agents, around agents that do autonomous work, and all the rest. But I still think all of that can still tie to an increase in human agency. And part of, and this kind of the final part of this initial answer is, super agency is not just the superpowers that an individual gets. It's the superpowers that we get. So it's human agency, not just as an individual agency, but human agency also as teams, companies, industries, societies, and humanity.
Okay, so this was a great explanation, but in some sense, you dodged my answer. Like, you are saying you're writing for all of them, but like, it's very clearly written from a bloomer perspective.
Yes.
And I would even say sometimes a little bit dismissive of the doomer's perspective. And so why is that?
I'm probably most negative on the doomer perspective of the four, but it's partially because the only way you get to futures that you want is by steering towards those futures, not by steering away from the futures you don't want. And so the, oh, this is just negative. Oh, this is just a risk. For example, a classic conversation that I've had over the last couple of years is, can you prove to me that we won't create Terminator robots? And the answer, of course I can't. It's both some human fool might do that deliberately, some human fool might do that accidentally. And that gets, and then they say, ah, but then doesn't that QED, precautionary principle, we should stop all work on this, we should massively slow it down until you can prove that? And it's like, actually, there's lots of things that I can't prove. I can't prove that some fool won't create a pandemic with biological things. Should we stop all biological work? No. And by the way, because the way that we navigate a future pandemic is by doing good biological work and navigating that. Similarly, the way that we navigate the killer robot is by doing good AI work and by navigating that. And so it's not to say that the future is risk-free. It's a bloomer perspective on navigating, and that the doomer advocacy actually, in fact, doesn't have the outputs that they hope that their advocacy would have for. And so that's why I'm probably a little bit more dismissive, although by including them and by being in dialogue, I'm hopefully not being overly dismissive.
You definitely are respectful, but again, you are a bit dismissive. So in particular, like, you talk about the precautionary principle and why it might be a little bit too strongly taken by some in the context of AI. But like, when you talk about the use of data, you just says, okay, you, like, I think are not very positive on the GDPR idea. And you say we should have waited with any such regulation until we see something actually badly happens. Yeah. But don't you think there is a bit of a one-way door to some of these things that kind of, yes, for some of these things, if you can unwind it, then you should probably try it and then see if something goes wrong, then you unwind it. But for some of these things, once the data is out there, it's out there. So again, aren't you a little bit too dismissive of people who are worried that some of the consequences, like, we may run into some of the consequences that we will not be able to unwind once we realize they were wrong?
I do think that a precautionary principle about the one-way doors that have large catastrophic impact. So that's part of the reason, is because we've participated in, is what are the things that where rogue states, terrorists, other folks might use these things for example, bioterrorism. And you do want to try to prevent that. And that's worth preventing in advance. Now, but for GDPR, now, the fact is, the data in many ways that AI systems train out there, it's not like hacking systems. It's pulling data that's like on the internet. It's available. The data is out there already. And then the question is, can you use it for doing this kind of thing? And say, that's not actually, in fact, necessarily a fully one-way door. And what's more, most of that is not the great harms that you're looking at when you think about like bioterrorism. So that's also more navigable, even if they're saying, well, what if this individual felt that their data was something they didn't know it was on the internet, they didn't want it to be trained, they didn't want it to be able to be an answer in a chatbot kind of thing. It's like, look, there's some navigation that happens that as we're tuning, we will try to get that individual better participating. What is like the notion of copyright of and control over my own data? What does that mean? And by the way, what should we fully allow it to mean? Because one of the things that most people, for example, a classic discussion I have within Europe is like, I own my own data. Actually, that's not clear that's the right metaphor for this, because, all right, so here we are in a studio that we've rented, and a picture is taken of the two of us. Does the studio own it? Does the person taking the picture own it? Do you own it? Do I own it? Does the city that we're in own it? Like, this notion of ownership of data actually is frequently too simplistically stated. And actually, in fact, once you begin to look at data, what we do is we have a whole set of principles about how data can be used to the welfare of individuals and the welfare of society, and that it is actually, in fact, a bunch of more subtle decisions that are not just Alex owns this data. And the GDPR way that you're essentially preventing the future is not preventing only this catastrophic bad things, but also a lot of the innovation about what kinds of tools, amplification intelligence, what kind of places you can go. And in the context when I'm speaking in Europe and I'm trying to get them to be being more, because I would love Europe to be one of the kind of leading creators and inventors of AI in kind of a multipolar world for kind of a set of values that we want to be embedded in this AI. The precise reason I give them grief is because their regulatory stance almost ensures that they will be not in the game, very far behind the game. Matter of fact, just for entertainment for our podcast listeners, I will tell the metaphor that I've constructed to try to get them on side to think about it. So if you think of AI as a World Cup football match, and for our non-American literature, for American listeners,
exactly,
that's soccer.
Yeah.
But for the rest of the world, that's football. And by the way, more logically football, because you kick it with your foot. But if you think of AI as a World Cup match between the AI, between the China and the US, and what Europe is trying to be as the referee, you have two problems. The first is the referee never wins. And second is, no one really likes the referee. So being on the pitch really matters. And that's the thing of trying to say, how do you get kind of Europe on the pitch?
Okay, so that's a very interesting position, and you touch on a lot of threads I want to come back to later.
Yeah.
But for now, just again, on this data thing, I completely agree that this is extremely subtle and nuanced question. The problem I have here is a little bit that saying, okay, your stance is, I'm a little bit exaggerating, it's just saying it's complicated, so you cannot have a simplistic solution, just leave it alone and see how it happens. But like, at some point you would want this nuanced view of saying, hey, now we see what are the ways in which this data, like this access to data, might be a problem. And let's figure out what piece of regulation we need here. And this is not happening. So what do you think it will take for this to happen?
Look, part of the reason why I think the nuance of sorting it out can be broadly a trailing thing versus a leading thing. Let me reflect another conversation that I had with a bunch of Hollywood folks, because I got invited to this Hollywood meeting because they wanted to say, we think you can only create, and Disney wasn't there, so I'll use Disney as the example, because you can only create these Disney characters if you have access to the Disney copyright IP. And we think that that's the only way that the AI can do this, and so we're being stolen from. And if you kind of look at it, you said, and they, because the Western companies are being engaging and trying to say, hey, how do we pay you? How to make it engage? They think, we have this classic IP monopolist position. I said, look, let me tell you two facts to factor in your thinking. Fact number one is, if the thing that you wanted to exist today, which is an IP database that all training companies, training AI models would only either use in training or inference, would only be with explicit agreement with you, the AI models could still create Disney characters. And what's more, even if that existed, they would be able to create as good Disney characters, because there's a lot of content out there in the web that isn't in your IP database that tells you what Mickey Mouse looks like, how to make a Mickey Mouse, how to do it in all kinds of different ways. And at most, it only slows down the training some, because these AIs are very good generalizers, very good learners from lots of the set of data. So it isn't actually, in fact, they can't do it even if you excluded all of the stuff that you had trademarks on, had copyright on, et cetera, they'd still be able to get there and do that, maybe just a little slower. So that's the gap. Now, the further problem is the Chinese don't care. And the Chinese are going to go create the open source models or other kinds of things or access to them using all of this. So the thing is, when you think about data, and the thing you, in this metaphorical example is the Disney thing, that's going to be out there and doing it. So we have to navigate that world as doing it. Now, I want there to be a good role for incenting creators. It's part of the reason why I believe in IP and copyright and everything else. Sometimes it's taken too far as a kind of a ongoing, like the length of time that things are in copyright is actually, in fact, growing and growing, and it's unclear that it really should be. And so the Creative Commons and other kinds of efforts on this. But that's what I mean by when this gets to this whole world of data, because you go, okay, should we be figuring out ways that data is better navigated for both individual and social well-being? The answer is yes, but we have to do it within a global context, which means that your tools for doing it are very limited. And as we get into the future, we will have a better sense of what the shape, the actual shape of that configuration is. That doesn't mean there won't be some harms done now, some harms done along the way, and that will happen. And as an author who owns copyright on things and so forth, I understand that and participate in that. But it's a question of, I actually think for society, the creation of these AIs giving us super agency is going to be so good. And part of the thing is we want to make sure that the various Western societies are at the leading forefront where, you know, in competition with societies like China, which are autocratic and have a different set of agendas, we want to make sure that we're not falling behind in that. And that's part of the reason why the cautionary of being more sort out the data regulation as we're going, trailing versus leading, is part of why I take that advocacy position.
Okay, so this is a very interesting position, and I resonate with many parts of it, but I want to deconstruct it a little bit. Because there is a question of, okay, how effective is the current regulation at regulating properly things that we live through in the world of AI? And as you gave an example with the IP, just like there is this power of AI and actually internet and just digital data of sometimes just giving access to data, like we were thinking about, let's say, access to the birth certificates or other things, which it used to be that you could walk into a town hall and just get a birth certificate of anyone. Now it's no longer the case because people realize you can aggregate this data, you can digitalize this data and infer from this much more than you would expect. So this goes back to your like question of you can recreate a Disney character even without ever explicit training on any of the Disney content. So that's a reality. Now there's a question of what is the perfect world? Like, okay, we want the Western countries to be leading here. We want this society to benefit. And that's a vision. That's important to have a vision we agree on. But then there is a question of individual or like interest of certain groups can be not necessarily aligned this way. And there is a question of a process. How do we get there? And I'm just saying is that trying to orchestrate all of this together will be difficult. And I do worry that sometimes kind of people who have like genuinely say, okay, this is the world, at least we know, that is not exploding. So let's be careful before we make big changes to this world. There is some merit here. Maybe that's the only thing I want you to a little bit to concede here.
So look, I also have a variety of don't break major things, including this world or yes. society. But it also has to be done, like the question is, what's the best way to do that? And to be simple, you could say, let's do everything we can to be slow. I'm being hyperbolic here. Slow and deciding for the people who will be slow and deciding and be slow and deliberate on that versus let's try to be in the forefront of the race on doing that. And this is my precise problem with a lot of the X-Risk people, a lot of the doomers, et cetera, because it's, if legitimately there was a thesis where 8 billion people would get together and say, we're all going to agree that we think this is a critical risk and we're all going to slow down and we're all going to do that and we're not going to be advocating, then there's a possible there. But then you say, this is around an abstract thing where the real harms haven't actually really shown. And if you could organize that, you'd think you'd see it around climate change. You'd think you'd see it around, like if that was a viable thesis, you'd see it around much more tangible things. So I disagree with the thesis that you can get the X billion people aligned on that.
Yeah, so again, no disagreement here, sadly. Like I completely like the practicality of this. I completely am in tune. I'm just saying, I did feel sometimes in the book you were too dismissive on principles, not on the practicality of people who are kind of more cautious there. Again, I'm not with them either directly, but I recognize where they're coming from. And it did feel like you were very dismissive. Actually, like here in this podcast, you gave much better explanation of your position here than this comes across from the book.
Yeah.
But I guess you cannot have everything in the book.
Yeah, and maybe I should, maybe this provocation's good that I should go into writing this kind of in another thing, the follow-up and more deliberate on this, because it isn't, by the way, and it isn't, as you're familiar in the book, it isn't that I don't think that people raising concerns is bad.
There's some that's people, not what I was claiming.
Like, well, no, I noticed that. But there's some Zoomers like, oh, you all this raising concerns, this is bad. No, I actually think raising concerns is good. But I think the question is, how do you raise concerns in a way that's constructive to the goal that you want?
Yes.
And if you say, hey, maximum preservation of the quality of human society is the goal I want, it's like, great, I agree with that goal. I think that you need to express the concerns differently in order to productively maximize chance towards that goal. And that's the tension of the disagreement.
Yeah, and I think here we can completely agree. I actually really admire about you this like practicality about like you are an idealist who is practical, yes. Which actually is similar to me. So now we are completely in tune. And in particular, I very much resonate with your principle of the best way to ensure good future or to prevent bad future is to try to envision and lead us towards a good future.
Yes.
So speaking of that, so you mentioned already that like the title says it all, I guess. It's your book is about trying to paint this vision of how AI empowers people, gives them more agency. So could you make it a bit more concrete? Could you describe, and you do it in the book, I just want to give you an opportunity to do it on the podcast, is just what are the examples of like empowerment you have in mind using AI?
And actually, I'll start with, because on the podcast, we're also going a little bit more nuanced in some ways than we did in the book, is agency gets transformed. So the fact is that on the other side of major technological revolutions, for example, like the AI being like one of the, maybe even the most, but like a massive technological revolution, there is agency that we had before that you won't have afterwards. So it's not, it's just, oh, it's agency plus, it's a transformation, but a transformation that grows the overall agency. And so, for example, it's like if I, my agency is my work, was I was a driver of a horse and buggy carriage car comes along, I no longer have that agency. I have to transform my agency to driving a car, to doing other kinds of things as ways of doing it, as a very simple parallel. Now, what are the ways that our agency will get massively increased? So part of it is to think, well, and this is again like a kind of a pawn on agent, like people say, but are you telling me that the technology will have agency and that will take away from my agency? Mm-hmm. See, one of the beauties of the word and the concept, the word agent, the word, the concept of agency in the English language is I can have an agent. I can have a travel agent. I can have a, I can have an executive assistant. I can have, I have a book agent. Like there are roles within agency where it says, but actually, in fact, my travel agent enhances my agency. My book agent enhances my agency. My executive assistant enhances my agency. And so even when you're creating this agentic technology of something that can go out, do things, have autonomous goals and do stuff, it can actually still be enhancing my agency. Just as the way within human agency, we have these different kinds of agents. And so when you have these superpowers within this agentic world, this is the kind of the agentic design principle of, hey, be thinking about how it increases human agency. It's not, oh, the human has to do everything because just like I have a travel agent or a book agent, it's, no, but it's enhancing my ability within my kind of expression of myself, my capabilities, et cetera. So you say, okay, but isn't ChatGPT writing this essay for me taking away my agency of writing this essay? And you're like, not necessarily. Depends on how you look at it and what you do with it. If I say, I only have 3 hours to write this essay and I could do it from a blank page and go there, or I could start with it and be iterating and doing, and I still do the same 3 hours, the quality of what I will do will be so much better. The approach for how I get there, the solution to the blank page problem. And so then you say, what does this mean for me and for us? I will have a bunch of enhancements of my capabilities in doing things. I'll have agents that will do things on my behalf, and I'll have agents that are available to me to help me with things. So, for example, to make it very tangible for people, like we can now today construct a medical assistant that's better than the average GP. That doesn't mean GPs need to go away. Plus, the medical assistant plus GP is a much better future. But it's available 24/7, available to everyone at a cost that's probably a computation inference cost of $5 or less per hour. So you go, okay, any place where you can afford the $5 or less per hour, universal medical. By the way, lawyer, too. By the way, education, too, as a tutor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is a massive increase in my availability, capability, agency, et cetera. And then that gets to how do we then transform our various institutions to have that be part of what we are. And then the last part to go into the super agency side is part of it is that when you get the superpowers as well as I'm getting the superpowers, you're getting the superpowers also enhances my agency. For example, come back to the medical assistant. Like when cars were invented, not only could I drive to go see the doctor, But for example, say I'm really ill, the doctor can drive to come see me. Not only can I consult with a medical assistant, but the doctor using the medical assistant, both for herself or himself doing this, or also talking to my medical assistant agent, can then do a much better job much more quickly to go, oh, no, this is something actually I think the agent might have missed that we need to look at, or this is a way of putting the kind of the human touch on it in a way that really matters for you. And the fact that I have eyes on you and I may have known you for a while, et cetera, in terms of how this all navigates. And that's part of what this elevation of super agency is.
Yeah. So when you say all of these things, I'm totally on board. But again, then I was reading your book and you talk about this like network autonomy. That's the concept you come up with there, which is, I think, very accurate. And you give this example of this donor party kind of in the, in the 19th century, where like they had more autonomy. There was much less law. It was like Wild West. You can do whatever you want, pretty much. But of course, like for them, getting from the East Coast to Oregon was a much more grueling journey than now. You can just have your phone charged and your credit card with you, and you can go anywhere much more easily. So this is all persuasive. But then you were talking about things like, oh, imagine that like the traffic is enforced by AI automatically, that if you park somewhere, it automatically charges you a fine if you are after the parking. And then I'm starting saying, wait, like this being plugged into all of this, like this starts being uncomfortable. Yes, like I feel that this, we are getting again into the agency, because how do you automate things in a way that doesn't take away my agency? And is this kind of this like future where like you are like really plugged in with AI, doing a lot of things like behind our backs, supposedly to implement the way our society works? Is it utopia or is it dystopia? Because to be honest, I cannot decide.
I actually think we need to have a different word than utopia, maybe potopia or something, positive topia. Because utopia actually literally in the Greek, as you may know, is no place.
Yes.
And I actually think this is why the human agency design and the human well-being, the human elevation design is that principle, because we already have today have a lot of things working in the background that is part of how our society works. And actually, in fact, we go, okay, and like one question of agency is you say, okay, how do you approach your taking an Uber ride? So if you go, oh, I summon it, it's there, it comes because I asked for it, it takes me where it is, it gives me this kind of increased agency and mobility, or goes, oh, it's the only way I can get there. I'm summoning someone. I don't know how good of a driver they are. I'm fearful about getting into an unknown person's car, et cetera, et cetera. Then it's, I feel like I'm trapped in it, but I have to do it. And so agency is also in part of mindset. And most people then adopt to, hey, I'm either going to be taking Ubers this way, in this way that it's an extension of my agency, or I'm not going to be doing it. And I'm going to be figuring out something else. But the whole background of how Uber's operating is an enhancement of my agency. Now, the way to think about this is, what is the way that we set up the fabric of our society? And part of the reason in super agency we go through this kind of consent of the governed is people frequently say, well, setting up the fabric, that's the regulatory agency, this classic European GDPR, et cetera. That's the central decision makers deciding this. No, actually, in fact, having networks adapting is really good. Networks of customers, networks of employees, networks of shareholders, networks of businesses doing business, networks of press investigating things and causing certain brand shifts to move and so forth. All of that is actually adaptation to getting to the right place. And what you want is you want to have where people feel that AI is for them and is for their interests in terms of how it's operating. And let me use, for example, one of the frequent criticisms of modern tech is surveillance capitalism, because they go, it's surveillance and surveillance is bad. And so, but actually, in fact, I like surveillance medicine, right? Because actually, in fact, knowing if I'm like something's going wrong with me, it's precisely when I go to the hospital, it's precisely the reason why I might wear a Whoop, an Oura Ring, et cetera, an Apple Watch for doing this, because that's for me. And actually, in fact, when people say, hey, surveillance really bad, they forget, for example, London's CCTV. Because of the Irish bombings and all the rest, London adopted a broad spread intensive CCTV program that actually Londoners really like and visitors really, because it's only used for them, not against them. It's not like East Germany.
Some people disagree with that,
But the vast majority agree. Sure. And in part, it's part of what makes London a safer city and a bunch of other things. Because look, we're only looking for things that are crimes. We're only looking for things that are medical emergencies. We're only looking for that sort of thing. That's all. And we don't use it for anything else. We don't use it for, and we have a healthy governance system to make sure that's all that it's used for. Now, there's always a danger when you have it is when you shift to an unhealthy governance system, what could happen? And frequent people who are about technological limitation of government tend to think that we should disempower them because government can always turn bad. The problem is, should you put your energy towards not having government turn bad or put your energy towards limiting the technological capabilities of governments? I actually think, generally speaking, putting your energy towards good governance and having that is actually the better way of putting your energy into it. So wrapping back to the AI thing, of course, there's going to be a whole bunch of AI things that are going on that I'm not really fully aware of, that even when the company is transparent about it and has published its principles about what it's doing, when it has some relationship with press and employees and governance agencies and all the rest, there's a bunch of stuff happening. But it's like we just need to make sure that the systems are broadly learning and adaptive to a better individual human agency and society and a better collective social, societal agency and well-being. And that's an iterative process.
Okay, so as always, like, I'm really happy to press you a bit on these things because then I'm getting even more interesting insights into what informed what you wrote. But just here is one more incongruency that I'm seeing, maybe only an apparent one, but not really a real one. It's, okay, you say the way, like, to understand or like to decide if a given automation is enhancing my agency or taking away is a matter of my framing, my a kind of way I treat it and my choice, my informed choice.
Yes.
But then even in your book, you say, actually, you cannot really opt out of internet these days. Yep. You cannot opt out of highway these ways. You have a choice or you don't have a choice. The same is with Ubers of the world. Like soon, maybe we will move away. Maybe we will be having to take Waymos everywhere. So like this choice is a little bit illusionary. And also the informed part, which I think you already hinted, is saying, I don't expect like everyone to have insight into how AI exactly works and what's exactly happening. So in some sense, I am very, just to be very clear, I'm very in line with your idea or where we would want to be. But I'm just saying there is a little bit of a feeling of you will be made happy or you will, like, we will enhance your agency whether you want it or not, because this will be better for you. So how do you think about that?
So there's definitely going to be, that's the reason I was saying most people, majority, etc., because there's always various forms of outliers who say, this is not what I choose. Ted Kaczynski didn't like electricity.
Okay.
No, but listen.
That's true.
Right. So, and if you go, I don't want electricity. Electricity is forced upon me by modern society. And you're like, yes, it is. If you want to live in modern society, everything we do, like almost everything we do, requires some backbone of electricity. And so you go, what happens is we generally go, okay, the vast majority of us participate this way, the vast majority of us get a better society this way. And that leads to, if you're really trying to choose against the vast majority, that puts you on an extreme outlier. And it's a very difficult choice to make. That happens if you say, I would like to never get into a car. That happens if you go, I don't want to use electricity. That happens if I don't want to use the highway, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, there's even more tangible ones. Like, for example, like one of the places where I'm very regulatory positive and give us a story is cars and seatbelts. A lot of innovations in cars happen not by because we had a centralized regulator doing GDPR saying, before your car can get on the road, you have to answer this 3,000-point checklist, which includes like bumpers on all sides of the car and blaring like little lights going, car coming, so that you could do all this. No, we let the car get on the road. We had some accidents and so forth. And by the way, a lot of the cars got innovated by just the market itself. But then we get to seatbelts. We go, people didn't want seatbelts, and the manufacturers didn't want to do seatbelts. But we as a society said, no, no, seatbelts better, because it greatly reduces injury. It greatly reduces the social cost that we have in hospitalization and all the rest. And so we're just going to mandate seatbelts. It's a cheap thing. It's something that people get a little grumpy about because the cars beep at them until they do it. But it's a good thing to have. But you discover that on the journey. You didn't start with that as an approach to doing it. And by the way, people grumpy about it, but that's okay. And that's an instance of regulation. Now, so that being said, we collectively get to where the social fabric of our technology is. And by the way, part of it is collectively, we don't imagine the future very well. Like when the car is first invented, we don't imagine what the things are. When the car was first deployed, One of the regulatory things was, as a person had to walk in front of it,
yeah,
waving an orange flag because it's very dangerous.
It was safe.
We don't imagine these futures. So part of the whole point of the book is to say, don't overly trust your individual or group collective imagination of the future. You actually have to get into it and then be iterating. And again, just as we talked about, some things, and you should have as simple a list as possible, are so catastrophic we need to really pre-think them in advance. But for the default of everything else, it's let's get into it some, let's learn about it some, and let's adjust as we go.
Okay. By the way, I realized that since GDPR emerged here as a nemesis, I just should explain to the listeners what it is. So this is essentially an, I don't remember what GDPR stands for off top of my head, but it's essentially a quite comprehensive set of regulations that EU impose about how the data about us gathered on the internet can be processed. In particular, all this, whenever you go to European website, when they ask you about cookies, then that's what's coming. Actually, whenever you go from a European IP, I think that's where it's
exactly.
It shows up also on the US website. So that's the kind of, and I would say that definitely there are like, opinions are mixed about success of this regulation, and this is often used as an example of regulation that probably went too far without clear benefits. But again, like I think it's a little bit nuanced. Now, coming back to your car analogy, which I like, which you used in the book as well, but there you said something a bit different. Yes, like you said, look, and I agree with this point. It's just like there is innovation is safety. Yes, to be safe, like you need to also innovate because you need to develop technology that helps you be safe. But you seem to be suggesting in the book that like essentially safety will happen anyway because this will be a feature that the customers would do. But again, I think this was true at the beginning of the development of cars where they were just breaking down or exploding, whatever. Then clearly there was no one wanted to buy such a car. But over time, I think in the 50s and 60s, that's exactly where the seatbelt situation played out. It was, I think, this interest of the clients and the companies diverged, and it really took regulation to really get our cars to the level of safety that we are at now. And I remember someone was telling me that at some point they spoke to one of the executives in one of the American car companies, and the executive was complaining, saying, because of all this regulation, 80% of our R&D budget is on safety and reducing emissions. And this person was, and it was saying, oh, no, and just that's a waste. We could make cars faster and so on, but like we need to do that. And the person was saying, oh, it's 80? Can we make it 90? Because this is what actually we should be carrying. And that was a success of the regulation that was needed. So I'm just saying is that, again, I definitely agree that we cannot imagine the future that well. So it should be reactive. But I'm saying, yeah, regulations have to show up here.
Oh, actually, but that was the precise reason I brought up the seatbelt. Because that is a...
Yeah.
Because in innovation and safety, the principal point we were trying to make with some vigor is that you do get, and it continues, by the way, because it isn't, to go back to the car narrative, actually, in fact, crumple, airbags, et cetera, were continued to be developed as new features to why buy my car versus your car.
Yes.
They didn't come out by government-directed safety regulation. They came out by my car is safer. You should buy my car versus...
Yeah, but that only emerged after a while when the narrative of safety came in, and then there was the star ratings and so on. And that's.
But this is the whole point of it is the general kind of call it well-intentioned critical dialogue is the companies themselves don't actually, in fact, build the safety. The market actually, in fact, doesn't build the safety. And the answer is, yes, it does the entire time. But what I agree with is it's some safety. Like there are safety features. Some of the safety emerges by the natural action of companies in markets competing, in part because if they go, oh, I can differentiate against yours because mine's better on this vector, then you start getting innovation as safety on a very natural basis. And there could be a broad range. It could be brand. It could be motivating your employees. It could be any number of things that do that for natural market mechanisms. So you do get a bunch of safety from natural market mechanisms ongoing. But the reason I brought up seatbelts is because, no, that's not complete. And there is a role for governments. There is a role for safety institutes. There is a role. But it should be, at best, it's prevent catastrophic. And catastrophic is not, oh, look, the AI agent slandered Alex. That's not catastrophic. It may feel catastrophic to you.
It definitely would.
But it's not actually, in fact, catastrophic.
I think we need to pause this AI thing.
Exactly. But real catastrophic and then iterative as we're learning and going. Because, again, part of my point, even to like the doomers and so forth, is to have some epistemic humility about what is the exact shape of what we're going into. Because the answer is, even the smartest amongst us, I think, are going to get it very wrong. And by the way, I include that with me. So I'm like, I can give very specific predictions about here's the utopia, here's the dystopia, here's the potopia, et cetera, in terms of doing it. But I'm always have some skepticism in all of my answers because of that epistemic humility. And that's the reason I tend to go, oh, the real interesting question is, how do we navigate to be seeing as we're going? And what's the way that the tool set will be increasing our capabilities to choose the positive topias over the negative topias as we're going, and to think of ourselves as learning creatures, not just from the data, but also from the, oh, this is how our judgment should work. This is what the actual possibility landscape looks like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the iterative development mindset that I'm advocating with such vigor.
Definitely, you don't have to convince me to iterative deployment. Like, I'm a big fan of it. OpenAI was a known early adopter of iterative deployment, and I believe in it. Just, again, the one thing that I always want to be cautious about is just, if you look at climate change, right? As you said, like, we know it's coming, and okay, not everyone agrees, but most people agree. But even when among the people who agree, there is always this unwillingness of saying, okay, like, the connection between what I'm doing right now versus the change makes it, oh, it's like a tragedy of the commons in some ways. It's just, it's fine, and it's hard to get this collective action together. So, like, I think it comes from the fact that the more distant the effect, cause and effect is, the harder for us is to factor into, even in this iterative deployment. So anyway, this was great. I want to go back to one other aspect that I wanted to touch on when we talk about the agency. And the concept that shows up often when people talk about exactly not just AI doing everything for us, like automation, but collaborating with us, like being our agent, is this human in the loop concept. And honestly, like, I have a bit of trepidation with this concept, because everyone just throws the things like human in the loop. And they, even you saying the same, oh, when you have a doctor and an AI assistant, then clearly this will be better. Actually, that's not true. There were actually a couple of studies that shown that there is a question, like, it's not as easy that if I put AI model and a human, I will get a bet, like, I will get better than any of them. It's sometimes you get the worst. There is a question of over-reliance where a kind of people start deferring to AI. So how are you thinking about human in the loop? How do you set it up in a successful way? What are the recipes here?
So let me start with my irritation with those studies.
Okay,
great. Because I looked at those specific studies. Nice. I was like, oh, that was interesting. The problem is, the thing they measured is they said, okay, a doctor with almost no experience with AI before, now we're injecting AI. And so it's almost like, hey, I'm bringing you a new tool set, and oh my God, you're performing less well. And that kind of doesn't surprise me. Because the interesting question is not if you did a cold start, like you said, doctor group A, no experience with AI, doing their normal thing. Doctor group B, no experience with AI, now we're injecting AI in. Oh, look, doctor group A, better performant than Dr. Group B. Well, okay, that's predictable, right?
Yeah, but that's not actually the studies I'm talking about. Okay. So there was, it was a while ago. It was still before the previous era of AI, okay, when there were still expert systems, not the new ones. And the...
Oh, so you're going down, okay, I get. So I was talking about, there were some recent ones with GV, with modern systems.
Oh, yeah, that had that. Again, I'm an academic. I can always talk shit about papers and what they are doing. Like, I think this is, you are correct in this specific instance, but I'm saying there are others as well.
But the question about reliance then gets down to, look, the way you construct that, you say, what's the way that we should be training the AI systems to get, because this is with human agency, to get the doctor plus agent performance higher. What's the way we should be building the AI systems, and what's the way we should be building doctors? And by the way, those will change. And by the way, it isn't even a disbelief in the thesis that we couldn't get it to the point, like using the classic chess analogy that a lot of people use. First, it was the computers beat the humans. Then the humans plus the computers can beat the humans and the computers. And then the computers just beat all of them. Yeah. And that's the classic, that's the end state and all of these things, which I'm not convinced just because that played out in chess, that's the end state in every domain. But I get the metaphor of it. And it, TBD, probabilistic. But say, for example, you say, actually, in fact, the AI will actually do better medical decisioning unimpeded by any intervention by the egotistical humans who go, no, I think I know better. I got to prove my own value. Then I think that's a majority of Actually, in fact, I think you'll still have humans in the thing, but actually the humans have to be retrained a whole bunch in order to still get the better impulse. Because you have to understand, where is it that I'm actually going to be, like, I'm not going to be better on these things. And if I get to that point, but even in that circumstance, you don't want to have the AI agents working in a way like, oh, you dumb human, don't second guess my decisioning. Because part of what you want in the agent design, this is part of where super agency is written for technologists, is thinking about human agency. It's like, look, I may still think I have the right answer because I'm just like, I always win the Olympiad against both the humans and the humans plus machines, just doing it better. But part of my function here is to bring the human along with me to help them grow and evolve. And that's part of the function of the agent. And that's part of what we want in the design, the kind of the design lens for all these things. And so I think that the notion when it gets to this kind of human plus AI, I'm not saying it in a simplistic sense of it'll just always be the case, because sometimes the human's going to have to change. Actually, probably in all cases, the human's going to have to change some. It's a question, is it change 10% or change 98%? But it's in that range in this kind of thing. And then sometimes we're going to have to specifically nudge and change how we're training the AI for a fitness function that isn't just the what is the best medical advice, but also how is the whole system working, including how are the humans being brought along on this journey, both the doctor and the patient. And that's what I mean by that kind of design focus. And it isn't also even the case where I don't think we won't have places where we will just completely replace the humans. We will do that on a stack of things. And by the way, maybe even in this kind of AI-topia kind of things, it will be a lot of things. But by the way, I think we can navigate that Star Trek future too. The transitions will still be rough, but that's a good problem to have.
Okay, so I think here we are completely in agreement, and just the point that I want to hear from you was that recognition that this will be hard work to set up AI to really effectively work with humans. Like, the part of it is this over-reliance that over time we just think, okay, I will be just, yeah, if this is like a short email that the AI writes for me, then I can check the email and correct it. If it's a long thing, I just, after a while, okay, I checked it, like 300 emails before was good. This one is probably also good. I will just send it without reading. And so that's one over-reliance question. Then there is also the other question that when I imagine my company bought this AI system and the CEO is excited for like having paid hundreds of millions of dollars to implement it, and I am somewhere in this process and I'm supposed to supervise AI. But sometimes there is a call and I'm not sure, and actually I think, okay, this is AI trained by OpenAI. Who am I to second guess it? Or even there was this saying in the 90s that like no one gets fired by buying from IBM, is saying no one gets fired by going along with AI, but I can get fired if I countermand it and I'm wrong. So all of this like organizational and technological and psychological aspects need to be addressed. So that's why my trepidation was, which I'm happy to hear and not surprised to hear, that you understand that there is a lot of hard work to really make it work. So maybe the last thing in this thread I wanted to ask you about is just about the question of building trust in AI. Okay, so guess what? AI is amazing. I'm amazed by all the progress that's happening both publicly and within OpenAI. Like, crazy stuff is happening. But AI will not be like flawless. It will make mistakes. And currently, like, we are extremely allergic to any mistake made by AI. Even though, and that's the usual playbook, is just when you show that humans are much worse at this anyway. But somehow, like, when humans make mistakes, when they are discriminating and they are completely inscrutable, that's fine. But when AI does any of this, it's a big problem. So how do you think what should the rollout be here so we start building trust in imperfect AI? Or does AI has to be perfect before we really can embrace it?
So I think we agree that waiting for perfection is actually, in fact, will cause a lot of human suffering.
Yeah.
Because if you say, hey, we could roll out these medical assistants right now, and a whole bunch of people who don't have access to doctors, don't have access to medical assistants, et cetera, actually, in fact, their lives could be improved. How they navigate their children, things going on with their children, their family members, other things, all could be much, much better. So we have to accept some imperfection. And we need to build our accountability and our liability systems around that in order to make that happen. And currently, they're not set up for that because currently, basically, it's we understand limits to accountability and liability of another human being, but not for a machine in terms of this. And that's a mistake that's costing a lot of human suffering and death and other things. So it's like, okay, we should fix that. Now, I think the way to, and by the way, we even see it in some places of technology, like this is one of the things that happens in the vaccine dispute, because it's a little bit invisible to people. There are sometimes some people who have adverse reactions to vaccines, and they go, I fear that I might be the person who have an adverse reaction to vaccine. And yet, collectively, we are all much better off when we all when we get bulk vaccinated on something, and it's much better, even though there's a lottery assortment of some people who have some side effects, other kinds of things as ways of doing that. And that's another version of this kind of technology of, I don't expect perfection. I expect, like, I have to learn that we are better as a group when this happens, and kind of participate in that better of the group, and make sure that smart people are studying it and so forth. And this is part of what I think is perhaps one of the things that I think has been gone most wrong in the last few decades of American society, is an overly critical teardown of expertise. Because it's not that experts should be treated as 100% right on everything and golden, but actually, in fact, we have made so much progress through expertise. Panels of scientists and germ theory, panels of scientists on for vaccines, and also panels of scientists on technological development. But also, by the way, juries in judicial systems, et cetera. And so we want to actually, in fact, say, no, expertise is really important. And there's times where I'm deferring to expertise because the expertise system is working well. And this is where our kind of, well, less pioneer, frontier, libertarian actually can get very wrong. And that doesn't mean they say, well, you mean trust experts about everything? It's, no, it's to have a well-functioning system that's that embeds expertise and is improving and learning as you're going. And I think that's the kind of parallel that we want for what's going on with AI. Because we go, look, will most people understand AI? No. Matter of fact, most of the people, like one of the things that's as bewildering about modern large AI systems is that there are these complex things that have turned this into kind of a natural science. Like, we're discovering things. Like, we just didn't even know. It's not a mathematical science as much as there's a lot of math in it, but as much as a natural science. And we go, okay, so then how do we build trust in these things? It's, well, because we have a rigorous human expertise process that's answering questions, that's surviving scrutiny and red teaming testing and a bunch of other things that are actually very good about this. And so where you want to build trust is, oh, I think that this is a smart, healthy, scientific process that is being public and accountable on the right kinds of things. And that, by the way, those are evolving too. And how does your actual everyday citizen end up getting to this kind of trust? Is a trust in the systems and a trust in what it is, but also as they trust what they see as the results. It's one of the reasons why, you know, part of what when I've told kind of various government officials the things that they should actually steer towards trying to get as soon as possible as a medical assistant. Because as soon as I suddenly realize that, like, very few people, other than going to an emergency room at a hospital, which a very small number of people have access to, I have a medical question at Friday at 11 p.m. I don't know if it's urgent or not. Is this rash on my baby's arm? Is this something that I should be going, get me to a hospital, get me to a doctor? Or is it like, oh, that's okay. Or, hey, I could just put this little bit of Benadryl cream on it and it's fine. Like, how do I navigate that? And get that into people's hands, because suddenly people are going, oh, this is something that's really magical for me. And you say, this is because of AI. And you're like, ah, I see somehow AI can be magical. And that's how you ultimately build trust.
Yeah, so I definitely resonate with this vision. Again, I will just call out over-reliance that sometimes people will just do the AI thing. Actually, some of my colleagues at OpenAI, they just stopped going to doctors because it just going to doctors is such a hassle. We are all so busy. And they just like use ChatGPT and seems to work for them. They seem to be healthy, knock on wood. But there is a little bit of over-reliance that sometimes it's just so convenient that and seems to be good. So it must be good. Yeah. I definitely worry. Also, I agree with you about the importance of experts as a system, not as a single expert. And I'm a bit worried about where we are right now. And yeah, definitely, I agree there is a question of benchmarks. Yeah, so one of these kind of examples of this, yeah, what do you compare? You're not saying we should get rid of the doctors. You're saying in addition to doctors, we should have also these things, especially where doctors are not available. And, you know, what this reminds me, there was a panel at some point at MIT where we had some One person was from Western countries, and she was saying about, oh yeah, we cannot allow AI to provide medical advice until this and this is checked, which is very high standard. And then there was a person from Africa there saying, wait, maybe for you in your big cities where you have the best doctors, this is very reasonable bar. For us in Africa, we will take AI doctor over no doctor anytime, so please don't decide for us. And there is this question of also the baselines. But again, it has to be informed because people need to build some trust.
By the way, there's a particular paradox that I think liberals frequently get themselves tied in knots about, which is bad, which is they go, should we then go provide those AI doctors to, for example, rural, African, other kinds of communities? They go, no, because we shouldn't be learning from their suffering on these broken systems. And you're like, you are being patronizing. Yes, we should ask them. We should tell them what the worries are. But if they choose to engage, that is their own adult decisions because they know their well-beings. I've literally been in arguments like this with some more academic-y lefty liberals on this. And it's like, no, treat their agency as real.
Exactly. No, definitely explain to them what's happening, what are the risks, but give them the choice. I think that's very important. Speaking of global picture, so when we spoke last time, we talked a little bit about geopolitics of AI. You had some interesting thoughts that I agreed with about what countries should try to accomplish here, what should we be doing. You talk also about this in this book, about what are the opportunities, but also what might be the cost of not taking these opportunities, like this example of is Loomers, right, in UK. So imagine UK during the revolution, like the, what's the revolution? The
Luddites.
Yes, the Luddites, if they actually won.
Yes.
So essentially during the Industrial Revolution. So that actually was very entertaining to read about this, because UK was the leader there, and you talk about importance of leading. So how do you think, since last time we spoke, how do you think things unfolded on geopolitical space? If we think about this football match with, I guess this is US versus China, with Europe being a referee, also where's this Middle East there? So what is your thoughts about the situation right now?
So a number of people in Silicon Valley argued, not unreasonably, that one of the benefits of Trump potentially winning the election would be advantageous within the AI race. And the kinds of benefits that they were arguing would be that we'd get, because we have actually tangled and bad energy regulation and we're not building enough energy for even kind of general purposes for doing this, that we have permitting and land and data centers, which is slow and difficult. And the frequent argument is like, it used to take a year to build a bridge, and now it takes 11 years and 100 times the cost and blah, 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 blah. And by the way, all of those are very good points. And I was like, okay, those are good points. And I still say I'm hopeful that we may still see that, because if you actually had a Trump administration that was actually, in fact, committed to intelligent governance and trying to accelerate our AI capabilities, they would be working on energy regulation, land use. They would be working on saying, hey, what are the ways that we enable this? And that would be, I think, good industrial policy relative to this. Instead, they seem to be engaging in needless tariff wars that are going to damage the lives of the majority of Americans, among other things. They seem to be thinking that woke AI is the important thing versus the kind of leading in AI things. And there's literally almost no evidence to that claim, but it allows political posturing versus difficult. So I would say that I'm, as obviously someone who is a critic of this administration and who tried to get Harris elected, I actually am open-minded and objective. I was hoping that this would be a kind of a benefit that we would be getting from this administration. I welcome them to start focusing on the real things to help with an AI industrial policy that would be actually, in fact, keeping kind of Western society, American society, kind of forefront in the loop. And I will see.
Yeah, so definitely moving on energy would be important for the US to move on. And I think they still intend to do that. Is that the only thing that the U.S. should be doing from the point of view of the geopolitics of AI?
I think there's a stack. So, for example, among the reasons why the tariff posture is damaging for America is that the tariff posture, I've already seen it. In March, I was going around Europe a lot. I've already seen Europe start saying, oh, the U.S. is an unreliable partner. Maybe China will be a reliable partner. And so maybe we should actually be working much more with the Chinese. Like the paradox is you have an administration here that's saying, we're doing all this because we need to be in this competition with China. So if you're actually going to intend to compete with China, you don't compete with China by going America only. We are going to hit all our friends and allies and partners with sticks in order to do that. So you form alliances and partnerships, and you should be saying, hey, this is the way that we're going to be working with you on these kinds of things, and this is going to be a positive thing. And so the kind of negative things around American AI are literally, I've participated in a number of conversations where the various both business people and European government folks are saying, look, we agree that we share more values with democracies and so forth, but if you're going to be an unreliable, imposing random tariffs, unreliable about access to these technologies, et cetera, and you're going to be doing not just America first, but actually evincing what looks like an America only policy, then maybe even though we share less values with them, maybe we should partner more with the Chinese. And so there's a whole stack of things that are happening that we should be more, call it partner-minded on in terms of what we're doing, that would be successful in saying we want to be the leader in the world in artificial intelligence, make it American intelligence, but you can only do that by partnering well. And I think that's one of the things that is a highly negative motion that's happening this year.
Okay, so US should build this coalition of Western, or like more than Western, but kind of Western values, kind
Western
of
plus.
AI. And I think in the book you make this point that like we do want the democracies to lead in AI because they have the vested interest in making this like agency enhancing version of AI future to come to be. So I agree with that. So what about Europe? So Europe now is, they either can play ball with, again, going back to the football analogy, play ball with US or China? Is that the only choice they have?
No, actually, part of, I think, what we want as American citizens and as also humanists is we want actually Europe doing a variety of its own AI efforts. Now, whether or not Europe will get to the scale compute efforts, kind of TBD, although there's various ways that they could try to get there. But there's lots of paths, and like it's not just whoever builds the largest model, that's the end, the one all and end all and be all. There's some utility to the largest model in various ways, but I think there's just tons of things going on. I think there's like part of it was like, look at DeepSeek and think of that as a notion of interesting hopefulness, because DeepSeek clearly had some distillation. I don't know what the full story and the creation of, but when you ask the early version of DeepSeek, who are you? It says, I'm ChatGPT, because that's a clear sign of a distillation process leading to getting there. But that also means that that's the kind of thing that Europe can do too. Like it isn't like DeepSeek was uniquely Chinese and was the only kind of thing that China could do. Now, not to go back and kick the GDPR horse again. Right? But again, like it's kind of like,
I would get my EU citizenship revoked after this podcast.
Yes, exactly. But it's maybe they couldn't do it there because of the GDPR and other the AI Act regulations. And it's about actually, in fact, being able to make something like DeepSeek is actually, in fact, useful. I would love to see a French version, a German version, a British version, a Polish version. I would love to see all of these things happen. I'd love to see them collaborating on singular versions as well. And I think that we are better off both as Americans and as humanists if Europe is developing in the game, not just trying to play the referee, but also on the pitch.
Okay, so how is your view? Like, this makes perfect sense. And as a European, again, I completely resonated with. This is similar to a message I send each time I go back. Let's see. This is TBD. What will happen? I think there is talent and there is some will to do something there. But now what about China? So how do you think, like, this definitely, like, the DeepSeek releases, that definitely propped up the view that China is really serious about AI, in a good position to be in the race for leadership in AI. So what do you expect to unfold there next?
So I think there is. A few years back, China announced that it wanted to have AI leadership by 2030. That's not too many years in the future. And I think that we should take that seriously. I think it's an enormously, I've learned a bunch from not just Chinese entrepreneurs and technologists and inventors, but also the way they run their companies and also certain things from the government. All the things we should be learning from that, because they are smart, driven, capable, and interesting people. And the principal reason why I advocate for what I call the Western democracy stance is the being multipolar. It's we're actually like why I like capitalism. We're both in the same society together. Why I like democracy. We're both in the same society together. I also want that kind of multipolarity between a variety of nations that's, that kind of share a set of values. And I think that the challenge that I have is the Chinese Communist Party tends to say, we were a democracy, we had one election ever. So that's not what a democracy is. It's a ongoing enfranchisement of the people where the leaders are held accountable to the people's ability to vote them out as a, as an instance. And I think that's an important part of that multipolarity. And that's the reason why I'm a strong advocate of Western democracies and the kinds of value systems that we have, and not just the US, US is one of them, being one of the AI or the or a primary AI leader in this. And that's, but this is again part of the thing of where we say, look, that's not just because if you adopt a America-only posture, that actually hurts our ability to do that. It's actually, in fact, working with Europe, working with Canada, working with the other, like working with Japan, working with a number of these other countries and being multipolar about this, even in an American leadership position, is, I think, extremely important. And the negative of that is actually, in fact, causing increasing our chances of failure. And so I think that the thing is we should take Chinese competition on this very seriously indeed.
Okay, that's, I definitely think we should take this very seriously. Now, switching away from geopolitics, in addition to be a great thinker about AI, you are also an investor, or probably you are first investor, or is also entrepreneur and thinker. Needless to say, AI attracted quite a lot of attention from investors of the last decade. Like, I think there is like billions of dollars poured into this business, into the AI labs, into building up the data centers. But where is the smart money in AI these days? What is the less obvious way of investing in AI that you think is worthwhile?
I'm always looking for those smart things. That's part of the reason why meeting with entrepreneurs, because it's the entrepreneur who is not thinking about building the 200th coding agent, but something that is has a very different point of view. It's similar to like when I met the Airbnb folks. It's like, the okay, that's thinking about the world in an entirely different way. Now, part of how I'm exemplifying that is I went, okay, actually, in fact, maybe one of the ways to do this is to go help co-found some companies. So I, because very early before the agentic revolution started, I co-founded Inflection with Mustafa Suleiman because it was like agents are going to be very big. The idea there was to train EQ as important as IQ. I think that idea is now beginning to be more broadly in the system. It helps with human agency and partnering with humans and all the all this sort of thing. I've now recently done AI, which is accelerate drug discovery and cure cancer as a way of doing it, because it's one of the things where I think most of the folks have a wrong approach of either it's all in silicon or it's biology plus whatever those computer, it's like as opposed to reinventing the process between the two of them. And that reinvention between the two of them is essentially what we're doing. And I think that we're already in the first few months, even beginning to see some interesting progress. So I think that's a very hopeful sign. And that's a way of doing something different, as because part of where smart money is, it's where do you buy low with the best risk things to selling high. It's not just buy low and sell high. It's a risk coefficient in the entire thing. By the way, for example, buying very low with even substantial risk, if it goes very high, can be very good. And buying medium or even premium medium, but with very low risk, can be very good at getting there. And so it's that set of things about what you're looking at. And that's part of the reason why smart investors also tend to pick leading shops. You know, why OpenAI can do impressive rounds, because here is a global leader in creating stuff. So there's a whole range of smart money and smart investing, but it's not just because someone put AI in the pitch, right?
No, okay.
Yes.
Too bad. You know?
And one of the more entertaining ones that I saw happen 15 whatever years ago in Silicon Valley was there have been a couple of very into entertaining companies. One of them I'll call out because I thought it was like I refused to take a meeting with the company was Juicero, because it was like, we're going to be applying software to a juicing machine. And you're like, look, there's a lot of juicing machines. It's not a software thing. I don't think this is a particularly good investment. Like you say, you had an AI Juicero.
Exactly.
Like, no, that's not a particular way of looking. Now, I do think there will be a whole bunch of AI application companies that will be very valuable, that won't be necessarily pre-training their own sizable models. They may be doing some models and everything else, and then developing applications that are very good. Brett Taylor's Sierra is an example of this. And I think that's just an example of a ton of those. So I think there's a ton of smart money investing there. I think that the notion of saying, because part of when you're smart is as an investor, you go, AI will be the new platform that's transforming things 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that's the trend that I should be investing in. Yes. And then not just because it puts AI in the slide deck, have a smarter sense of the technology, markets, entrepreneurs, et cetera. And it's one of the lenses that a Silicon Valley presence gives you, because that's such an intensely competitive and cooperative game that is played here.
Yeah, this was wonderful. I really am sorry we can't spend more time. Apparently, this was as much time as we could get gotten from you in your busy day. So let me just wrap up with a final question. So I asked it last time, I will ask it again this time. It's like, what it is that you personally look the most forward to or least forward to in terms of this our AI future?
So I'll say the thing that I think, and part of the reason I write Super Agency and my else is, where I think we can most screw it up as Western democracy, and I think it's part of what Europe has a tendency to do, is to say, like, we need to have everybody of 70-80% bought into each step in terms of what we're doing, and we need to work at that. And it's like, no, part of, I think, the kind of the genius and the intelligence of the Silicon Valley approach is, no, have some smart people go build some stuff and then iterate on that. And that's the fast way to make progress. Now, that's with all the discussion we had. But my worry is that we collectively break it because we say, no, like I'm a driver of planes, trains, automobiles, et cetera. I don't want autonomous vehicles. I have to be bought into this, et cetera. So, no, that will be breaking not just our future, but our children's future and everything else. Is let's collectively go into the future. That's what I worry about, Now, in terms of hopes, what I want is, I think that as more people get to being AI curious and participating, and part of the thing that I try to go advocate with Super Agency is for everybody, including me, I try to do this every week, try to take some serious good use for you in your work and your life and try to use it. By the way, it'll be broken on some things. And when you go, it's broken here. Like the most common thing I see academics do is they go, I asked to write a paper and I got the citation wrong. It's totally useless. I'm not going to do anything. Like, whoa, you're missing a whole lot of stuff for the broken citation. So it's, you know, be engaged in it and see where it is. And I'll give an example that I think shows the current thing. So A couple months ago, I had the delight and pleasure of sitting down with Atul Gawande, who's working on a book on anesthesiology. And he said, I'd like, and actually, by the way, this was a ChatGPT usage. He said, have you used deep research? And he said, no. And I said, okay. And because obviously prompting is good. I sat down and wrote a prompt in 30 seconds and generated the 10 minutes of deep research result. And he goes, oh my God, this is amazing. It gives me the direct quotations and the surgeons and so on. It's like, okay, let's send this to your research assistant and see. And I was expecting like 3 of the quotes to be wrong. As it turned out, 9 of the 10 quotes are wrong.
Oops.
Yeah. But you go, oh, useless. But no. Actually, in fact, the research assistant came back and said, look, 9 of the 10 quotes are wrong, but the areas where this pointed to me was gold and would have taken me tens of hours to find the area. So actually, even just the thing you generated helped accelerate my finding the things that you needed to do a really informed book. And that's the be serious about it, be engaged in it, be using it. Don't go, well, and by the way, this is the reliance point that you're making earlier. Don't just rely on it. Engage in an active way, and it still is a massive accelerant, a massive helper for getting high quality work. And that's my hope of what AI will mean for all of us.
Thank you. This was wonderful, and as always, it was so great to talk to you.
Always.
Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Reid Hoffman, an advocate for AI as an enabler, not a replacement for us. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If so, please share this podcast with your friends, subscribe, and leave feedback in the comments.